This is episode 2-1 of the Software Freedom Law Show for February 16th, 2010. Hi, I'm Karen Sandler.
And I'm Bradley Kuhn, and this is episode 2-1 of the Software Freedom Law Show. And we have a in-studio, or I guess in my office, guest today, which we don't have very often.
No, a very special guest, right?
Well, you always say that they're special guests, but when they're in the studio, that is special. That makes sense. But
in the studio, in your office.
In my office, right? The only other in-office guest we've had has been Aaron.
Is that true?
Yeah,
I thought we had one other guest that was in person.
No.
Oh, we just talked about having one.
So it is special, but it sounds strange to say a special guest.
But I am really excited about our guest today. And I guess now I have to worry about not describing somebody as special in future because...
Well, it is special if they're here because that doesn't happen that often, as I just described. So if they're on the phone, it's not as special because that's what we usually do. But when they're here, that's pretty special.
But anyway, I'm excited about having our guest today, who is Laura Moy, who's a legal research intern with us. So thank you for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me. I think of myself as special.
Well, it's very special that you're here, because it doesn't happen that often, which is sort of the definition of special.
Well, Laura's here quite often.
Well, but here in front of the microphone.
No, it's true, and being introduced to our
listeners. It's not like I carry around a microphone in the office, putting it in front of people on a regular basis.
No, but that might be fun to do one day.
What to do? Man in the street interviews?
Man in the street interviews at SFLC. Man in SFLC.
Person, I guess. They call it man in the street because it was invented in the 70s.
If you had it, it would be... the person you're interviewing.
Because it could be either.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, they call it that because it was invented during the sexist 1970s.
It's interviewing men on the street as opposed to the person doing the interviewing.
Right. That's and it was the 1970s when they started. There was some guy who famously invented that.
It's man first on the thought. Street.
Yeah, and they called it that. And it was like in the 70s sometime, back when things were much more sexist.
I think
that's why it's not called
I'll learn
on
more
the
about this when you link to it in the show notes.
Don't make me have to find that. I could be wrong on top of that. So then I'll have to say I'm wrong. And then now I have to say I'm wrong in the
All
show
right,
notes.
You won't see
it.
Anything in the show notes about
no,
this.
No, you will. You either see me saying it's wrong or I'll find the link. That's my two options now.
Well, are you going to make me make the joke about this topic that we want
to
talk about?
Well,
today?
Yeah, we should get to the topic. I'm not going to make you make any specific joke, but we were off topic because that's what Fab likes us to do. Fab is a host of another podcast, Laura. Sorry. See, we're getting like this, like I was talking about last time with the inside jokes in the podcast. Our guests are even confused.
Yeah.
So let's get.
We'll stick to topic.
We'll go on topic.
We'll avoid this
so
problem.
Fab can stop listening now. We'll go on topic. And what we're actually talking about today is something that's an important issue for you, and it's actually very close to your heart, right?
That's correct. It's literally close to my heart.
Ba-dum-bum.
Dun-dun-dun. And the reason we say that is because we're talking about medical devices, and this is a new-ish project that SFLC is working on. We are working on researching the situation of software and medical devices, and implantable medical devices in particular, and sort of exploring issues related to free software and implantable medical devices.
Well, we don't currently know of any implantable in-body medical devices that have free software in them. We're just not aware of any, are we?
No, I'm actually not aware. I don't think we've done any kind of survey, although I'm sure there are some implantable medical devices that have some free software on them, whether we know or not.
You think so?
I bet there are. I mean, there are so many implantable medical devices. It's sort of, since we've started doing this research, it's kind of really amazed me. But anyway, so what I wanted to mention here is the reason why I'm in particular so interested in it and why it's so close to my own heart is that I actually have an implantable medical device. I have a pacemaker defibrillator that is connected to my heart. About, I guess, 2 years ago now, I found out that I have a heart condition. That heart condition is that I have a big heart. I have a huge heart. My heart is about three times as big as a normal person's heart.
Was it like the Grinch after when his heart was three sizes too small?
You know, it's funny because I talked about this in one of those speed talks at Ignite, and I actually used the Grinch as a slide.
With his heart growing?
Three times. three times his size.
Yeah, for our international listeners, I'll link to that. It's a Dr. Seuss story.
Yeah, and it is. I mean, when I say it's a big heart, it's not like the whole thing is just scaled bigger. It's that the walls of my heart are much thicker. So the, you know, it has other implications. I actually don't have any symptoms right now or anything like that.
So you have jokes on both sides. Your heart is thicker, therefore harder to penetrate. In the sense of you can't.
It's actually,
and it's also larger, which tends to have the analogy
of being
warm.
It's actually stiffer. is like kind of the vocabulary they use to describe it.
The vocabulary used by the doctors.
Yeah,
and that has no sort of emotional analogy.
And
does
it's
it.
Scarred.
Oh, well, that definitely has an emotional analogy as well.
Yeah, and so I actually don't have any symptoms, as I was saying, but I am at a much higher risk of suddenly dying.
Like what kind of, what do you mean by higher risk?
It's about like a 2-3% per year risk of what they call sudden death.
Which is just heart failure, basically.
Well, it's heart failure is actually a technical term that refers to degeneration of the heart. I won't go into the details here of what sudden death means, but if you hear of, for example, athletes suddenly dying when they are exerting themselves, or people who sometimes die in the middle of a marathon, especially young, healthy people, this is sometimes what they have. And one of the things that they do when they find out that you, or one of the things they recommend if they determine that you're at a high risk, which 2-3% is considered a very high risk, is they recommend that you get a pacemaker defibrillator. So I have one of these devices, but it just sort of sits attached to my heart and basically sits dormant. It doesn't do anything except monitor my heart rate. And then if something happens, if I get into a dangerous rhythm where my heart is beating too fast and it looks like I might be at risk for sudden death, it delivers a shock. And, you know, presumably at that point I'm saved. It's basically like having, you know, EMT workers with paddles following me everywhere with the shock paddle therapy.
So have you experienced what that feels like? Or?
I have, actually. A year and a half ago? Something like that.
Right after you got it, I guess.
Yeah, like 6 months after I got it. I was at the gym and I got a shock. It was really weird. I didn't need it. It turned out to be an unnecessary shock, and we were able to adjust the settings of the device so that it didn't fire. It thought
so
my heart was being
twisted. So this relates to a software question. So how did they adjust the settings when it's already in your body?
Exactly. And there for a whole list of reasons. And it's so funny because when you start looking into these questions and how these devices work, there are so many different aspects to the technology and so many concerns that we have that, you know, some of which are related to the actual functioning of the software and some that are related to other technology. And I think what you're referring to, Bradley, is that there's a wireless component to some of these devices, and many of them are designed to be interacted with, over various wireless technologies.
Like just straight A-to-11 type wireless or something different?
Yeah, you know, well, mine actually is an older device because there's an article, and you know, Laura and I were just talking about this article. There's an article by the Medical Device Research Center where they went ahead and they actually were able to crack into one of the devices. They took one of these, like, exactly one of the devices that's very similar to the one that I have in my body. They put it in a big pile of meat, and then they basically used software-defined radio and some other really basic tools to try to talk to it. And not only were they able to talk to it, but they were actually able to disrupt the activity of the device. And so, and they were able to get information off of it. I mean,
right. They were able to get patient name, I believe the patient's social security number. They were able to get some highly sensitive, identifiable patient data just off of the device without an official device programmer. So the device manufacturers make not only the devices themselves, but they also make official programmers that are to be used by employees in hospitals to read the devices and communicate with the devices and change the settings. And this group was able to perform the functions that the programmer performs without the programmer.
In the little manual that I got with my heart device, they actually described the so-called programmer as being just like a television remote control.
So by programmer, we actually mean a physical device, not a person.
Yeah, exactly.
So before we get any more into those details, we obviously know why you got interested in this issue, Karen. That's, I think, obvious from what we've just been discussing. Laura, what gave you the interest in this particular issue to get started with it?
I am interested in, I'm very interested in human biology generally. I mean, I studied biological anthropology in college, and I grew up in a very medical-oriented family. There are a lot of doctors and nurses in my family, and I grew up just being very interested in these issues. So this intersection between technology and medicine and software was, and law, of course, was really just quite thrilling for me.
Because we didn't actually say that you're a law student. We sort of assumed, I guess, that a legal intern here would be a law student, but it might not be obvious to our listeners.
Right.
So what we were talking about, there could be, it's theoretically possible, some of these devices use free software. I think in a lot of the cases it probably doesn't, because the firmwares are probably relatively smaller than you would have for mm-hmm. a free software firmware. Putting Linux in one of these things is probably, yep. it's just too large to put into these kind of devices. We're just getting to the point now where things like audio players are big enough or have enough space to be Linux-based, and I doubt any of these devices, the computer component is big enough for that. So it's probably hand-coded firmwares in most cases. So let's talk a little bit how this relates to the free software issue and how it relates to source code.
I'm sorry, just to go back, because you asked me a question and I actually didn't answer it, and then we got a little...
That's okay. I don't expect all my questions to be answered.
Well, I just wanted to say
teachers never used to answer my questions either.
So that what, you know, when I started looking into getting a device, I raised these issues with my doctors, just overall security issues. And so I actually got an older device. So my device doesn't have the wireless technology and is talked to just through magnetic coupling. So that's sort of what, you know, what I have that's a little bit different.
And you also tried to ask for the source code to review, at least to review, so you could see what program was going in your body.
Right. Well, before this Medical Device Research Center paper came out, it took me a really long time to get comfortable with the idea of getting a device, and it was mostly because of the software. So the first thing that I did when I was told that I needed this device was I called the three major device manufacturers.
But actually, I think you did something before that. You made, actually, this is probably a mistake.
Freaked out.
You asked me if I would do it, if I would get something that had software in it that I couldn't get the source code to into my body, which I'm the wrong person to ask that question.
I asked you that before I asked
the source code. At one point you asked me, and I said, don't ask me that, because you know what my answer would be.
Yeah.
So that's probably a mistake, asking somebody like me that question.
Well, you know, everybody has to make these decisions for themselves, and I think there's a real fundamental issue here that's related to the source code of on these devices, which is a sort of a sense of, you know, what am I putting in my body, and you know, is there adequate information for me to feel comfortable with what's in there? You know, maybe this is a little off topic, but it's reminding me of all the articles that we've been reading recently about Toyota and the software problems in their cars and the Priuses. You know, it's one of those things where I think people are just starting to realize how much software there is in all of the different devices and equipment and everything that we use. I mean, so many things that we use every day and how much we rely on them. And I think that the ordinary person doesn't really think about that. And so when I started talking to my doctors and the drug company representatives and the device company representatives and started asking them, well, what is actually on these devices? How do they run? Nobody knew how to answer my questions. They said, well, call the technology people and the device companies. And when I did, they said, well, we can't really tell you too much about the software, and it's not published, and no, we're not going to provide it to you.
And when you compare this to, this opens up a bit of a can of worms, but when you compare it to chemical treatments, i.e. drugs that you might take for treatment, there are lots of problems with the pharmaceutical patenting system, but at least the patents disclose the chemical compound. And that's part of why the patents exist, is they have to disclose the chemical compound being used. In this case, there's no chemical compound because it's software, and that's not being disclosed. So it's not even analogous to the pharmaceutical system, where you can look up those patents and read what that chemical is and read the research papers that talk about how that chemical affects the body.
Right. It's true. Yeah. And there are numerous patents for the software operating on these devices. And the software operating on the programmers, and it really tells you absolutely nothing.
Well, and this is the difference between software patents and chemical mm-hmm. patents, right? The chemical patents disclose the chemical composition, which is the thing you need to know most. The software patents don't actually disclose the software. So it actually is exemplifying why software patents are so bad, because even though they disclose the patents on the software that might be in those medical devices, it doesn't actually tell you what software is running in your body.
It's right? so true. And what's really, you know, it's been a long time since I've looked at the Medtronic patents. So, you know, don't quote me on this one, but I think there was some Medtronic patent that was hilarious. It was like method for using a device to remotely talk to another within a for a medical purpose or something like that. It was just like something so basic that is now, you know, it's now a patent on implantable medical devices. It's, you know, and we don't have any of the software.
And it doesn't tell you what it actually
right,
does
exactly,
anyway.
Exactly.
It claims a system whereby something and a computer with a processor like the rest of them all do.
And just to clarify, because I don't think we mentioned it before, but Medtronic is the manufacturer of your device.
Yep.
But there's not just one manufacturer.
No,
they're all doing the same thing,
and
right?
And the reason why I went with Medtronic, and we're going to talk a lot about Medtronic, I think, and this is sort of an introduction to a work that we're doing that's ongoing. We're kind of just, you know, we've done a good amount of research, but it's something we're really working on. But you're going to hear about Medtronic. I use it as an example because that's what I'm familiar with, because that's what I have in my body and I'm most particular with. But I would say that the reason why I have a Medtronic device is because the doctors feel much more comfortable with Medtronic because they're very quick to come forward whenever they feel that there's a problem. And they work with doctors in recall situations in very positive ways. So the reasons why the doctors want to go with Medtronic is because they feel safer with them because they think they are more forthcoming than other medical device companies. So there is actually some incentive for the medical device companies to be more forthcoming with problems that they recognize because doctors really appreciate it. And even though Medtronic may have had more public recognitions of problems, doctors sort of feel like, well, all these companies are going to have problems. So, you know, it's sort of tricky. I did ask Medtronic, Boston Scientific, and St. Jude for whether I could get the software for their heart devices, and none of them were willing to give it to me. Eventually, you know, I talked to my doctors about my concerns, and basically I realized that I just needed to get one of these devices because I couldn't continue to be at risk for right. sudden death in that way, and that in fact we would work here on pointing out some of these problems.
Yeah, and it's been an issue that other people in the free software world have talked about as well. Mm-hmm. And now you're you're the first person in the free software world I've ever met that actually has one of these devices. So you're particularly well poised to look hard into this issue.
And I think this may be a good time to take a break, but when we come back, I'll talk about some of the questions that doctors had for us, had for me when I started asking questions and the kinds of things that we discovered in our research.
Okay. So we'll come back with more information about medical devices and disclosure of software thereof. So we're talking in this episode about medical devices and software in those medical devices, particularly ones that go inside your body. And Karen, in the last segment, told her story of how she has one of these devices for her heart. But Laura, how many people in the U.S. or whatever tend to have these devices? How common is it?
Well, just to give you an idea, in the year 2008, which is the year that Karen got her device, there were at least 350,000 pacemakers and 140,000 implantable cardioverter defibrillators, which is like a pacemaker coupled with a defibrillator. That's what Karen has implanted. So in short, there are millions of people with these devices. And that's just two different kinds of devices that are closely related. There are lots of other types of medical devices that are implanted in people's bodies. For example, a lot of people with diabetes have insulin pumps that deliver insulin directly into their bloodstream. And there are other types of drug pumps also that deliver other types of drugs. So millions of people worldwide with many different kinds of devices.
Yeah, and actually this Dick Cheney, Darth Vader himself, has one of these devices, right? One similar one.
Well, it's really funny because that was one of the, getting back to what, the kinds of weird conversations I would have with doctors, with cardiologists, electrophysiologists, and drug representatives, it was hard to get my initial wave of doctors to understand why I was concerned about this. And they would say things like, you know, I don't understand why you think that the devices, even if they are not secure, why would you think that someone would try to do something to interfere with its operation? And so the first thing I came up with at the time was, well, you know, Dick Cheney has one. How many congressmen and senators have them? How many judges have them? I mean, they're, you know, statistically speaking, you know, in a certain age group and certain, you know, group of people, you would expect there to be a, you know, a lot of people with them just because of what we know about who gets them and why.
And then did they call the Secret Service and the Department of Homeland Security on you because you were asking this question? You know, so sort of like asking to learn how to fly a plane but not how to land. They said, well, why is this woman asking these questions about how you get into these devices?
Well, and I think you're probably asking that because I did have a terrible experience with one electrophysiologist who
I forgot that, but
I was wondering if you had or hadn't, if you were sort of, he's not my electrophysiologist anymore, of course,
our listeners probably don't know what an electrophysiologist is, so we should probably.
Okay. So a cardiologist is a doctor that gives you, you know, that's basically specialized in heart matters, I guess. I wish I had a dictionary in front of me. An electrophysiologist deals with the electromagnetic operations of the heart. So when you talk about getting a heart device, it's basically a device that's got wires leading to your heart, and it delivers little electronic impulses, and that helps control how the heart beats. And you can get, they call them, the wires, they call them leads. You can get leads that go into your atria or leads that go into your ventricles. And it basically, all of the way that those electromagnetic aspects of the heart work are quite complicated, and so they have specialists that deal with
it. And the specialist sent to you.
And so this specialist, basically, I was sent to because my cardiologist said, you need a heart device, you know, and, you know, you need to talk to an electrophysiologist right away. And so basically the job of this electrophysiologist was to convince me that I needed to get surgery to get this heart device right away. And he hadn't thought about any of these issues, and it made me really uncomfortable. So I went away to think about it. And also I have no history of sudden death in my family, which is a big indicator. And I started reading a lot of the studies myself, and I saw that the data pools are not great, in that, you know, there are a lot of people who don't even, you know, this problem is probably more common than people think it is. And we don't have any way of knowing, because a lot of people only find out when they, you know, when they do an autopsy on a body that where somebody suddenly died, or there's some other problem and they happen to find out about it. I found out about it somewhat accidentally. So the statistical pool is completely off. So I wanted to go away and think about it. And after the New York Times ran an article about the Medical Device Research Center piece, you know, that we were talking about before, where they cracked into the devices and, you know, were able to run the batteries down, put them, you know, deliver shocks, I called them up and I said, well, you know, how about it? There's this problem. You know, other people are talking about it now. Do you understand, you know, can we talk about it more? And he said, I spoke to the Medtronic reps. They say it's okay. And I don't, you know, I think you're overreacting. And I said, well, I have real concerns. And he asked me these questions about, well, why do you think that someone would do something like this? You know, why do you think that you're at risk? And, you know, I started talking to him about, you know, about Dick Cheney and, you know, providing other examples. And, you know, and he said, well, I don't think that Medtronic would really release a product that wasn't safe. I said, well, you can't rely on companies to do that. And when we started talking about this in more depth, and he got very nervous. And I shouldn't have probably used the word, you know, the history of product liability. I shouldn't have used that phrase, and shouldn't have referred to Ford and things like that.
Shouldn't have been a lawyer when you talked to him.
And he said, you know, he said very nervously, well, something's going on here. If you want to get if you want a device, I'll help you. But otherwise, and then he hung up on me. Yeah. And it was so traumatic, because I just was worried about the safety of what was going in my body.
And I think the confusion comes up. This is a classic confusion related to the security through obscurity issue, which hopefully we'll talk about in a few minutes. But the general idea is that we're not talking about software freedom issues in the sense that we think everybody desperately needs the ability to modify what's in their body necessarily. I don't think I would want something in my body that actually was externally modifiable once it was in, at least not that easily.
I was trying to think of if there were any way I would want my medical device, my heart device, modified. Mm-hmm. And the best I could come up with was I could use it for an alarm clock in an emergency.
Well, and there's the theoretical bug fixing issue and so forth. But if technically you had to have surgery to get the bug fixed, mm-hmm. maybe it's not that horrible. If the other option is this, you have something that might not be secure. The real question of the software freedom issue here is not necessarily the freedom to modify, but the freedom to study and the freedom to learn mm-hmm. and the freedom to know what's in there. And that's sort of and of course that's the first freedom. So it makes sense that you guys are going after that first to really clarify that, because that's the most important freedom in this particular case.
And the general audibility of the code. So that
right, well, that's part of freedom to study,
I think. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. But sort of bringing that point home, which is something I've had to do a lot to my new cardiologist and my new electrophysiologist since I had to dump the first set, is that, you know, even if, you know, I did want to look at the code personally of the device that was going in my body. Mm-hmm. But even if I didn't want to look at my code, I would feel a lot safer knowing that some medical think tank or some other organization had the opportunity to look at the source code. I mean, if there are people who are devoting the resources to cracking into the device to show that they're unsafe in order to help make the devices more safe, then there will be people who are going and auditing the code, particularly if you get in the instance where there are bugs. And this is sort of conversations that's come up a lot in the discussion of the Toyota situation.
Right. So we know it's probably not the case that any of the stuff's based on GPL software, so we can't do GPL enforcement to get the source code. So then the question becomes, how do we introduce the freedom to study, a software freedom, into this process? What is the step, or at least the first step, that you guys have to take to try and get some level of software freedom, and particularly the most important freedom to study in this case, in these medical device cases?
Well, that's a really good question. And I think it comes down to a more basic question of, you know, what are the processes in place already to make sure that the devices are safe? And the review processes that are in place already, or the safeguards that are there, is the FDA approval process. So I thought, well, okay.
And for our international listeners, FDA is the Food and Drug Administration. Mm-hmm. It's the government agency in the U.S. under the executive branch that handles basically all regulation related to things of medicine and as well as food.
So, you know, my first thought is, well, you know, at least the FDA is probably reviewing the software and testing it. You know, while it's true that when I talked to the doctor, he said Medtronic said that the device is safe, so it must be safe. You know, when I heard that, I thought, well, that's overlaid with this device is approved by the FDA, so there's a level of safety. But when we actually looked into what the FDA looks at with regard to software, we were, and I guess are confused.
Right. We continue to be a little bit confused about what the FDA's review process is with respect to medical device software. There is a regulation that refers, it's referred to as good manufacturing practice, the GMP regulation. And that's part of the quality system regulation, which covers lots of system processes in medical device manufacture. And that regulation basically says that software operating on medical devices has to be validated, to make sure does what it is intended to do according to an established protocol. It's very gray. It's very vague.
Yeah, that rule sounds extremely vague, because what does it mean by validation, and who does the validation?
The FDA has released guidelines on these points, but then when you look at them,
they're non-binding. They actually say at the top of
they're non-binding.
Most of
I guess they're non-binding on everybody. But when you say non-binding, you mean non-binding on the
manufacturers.
Device, right? Yeah.
Right. So they're just they're basically suggestions, recommendations. They're the FDA's thoughts.
The FDA's thoughts on, you know, good ways to go about designing your software, good ways to go about testing it, but ultimately, the FDA believes that the medical device manufacturer knows what's best when it comes to medical device software and knows the best way to design it, the best way to test it, and they're not going to interfere with that, basically. So the FDA doesn't review the code.
So not only can we not see the code, not only patients who are receiving the devices, we can't see the code. Not only can, you know, third-party analysts see the code, but not even the FDA is seeing the code.
Now, is this a lobbyist thing? Is it that the lobbyists for these medical companies don't want this, or is it that they don't even think about it? Is it malice, or is it stupidity?
Yeah, you know, we're still in the, as I said, this is sort of, you know, a project we're undertaking. We don't have all the facts yet. We're not done with our research yet, but it seems to us that the FDA has the approach that the best way to evaluate the software is to read the own company, the manufacturer's own reports about their own software. So not right. reviewing the
so
code.
So by your own reports, do you mean design documents? Are they using like pure waterfall development model and therefore have a design document that the FDA reads? Or what does that document look like? Do you even know?
Well, we're not sure because we submitted a Freedom of Information Act request, a FOIA request, and we still haven't heard back.
So you haven't, you actually asked for what is it the FDA has on file with yes. regard to device X? Mm-hmm. Are they using your device as an example?
We chose a particular device. We didn't choose mine. We actually chose my dad's.
right, because you said this is a hereditary disorder.
Yes, but actually my father has sort of a different situation that caused mm-hmm. him to have a pacemaker, but it does prove the premise that cyborg parents have cyborg children. He likes that joke. Anyway, so we chose his line of devices because that has a wireless component to it, and it's a more recent device. My device, as I said, I got comfortable with getting the device by getting a much older one that can only be talked to with magnetic coupling. So actually, when I walk
somebody
into
has to put something against your
yes,
body.
Yes, exactly.
To get
so
to it.
So they the so-called programmer has to actually sit on my skin and be able to.
It's confusing me. So it's probably when you guys
it's
you
so
guys
confusing.
Keep saying
that's
the word
why
programmer,
I said so-called programmer.
You guys mean
it's like this,
like a physical
it,
device.
It basically looks like a giant white mouse. And what's kind of neat is that it locks into place with the magnet when on top of my device, so it sort of floats there attached to my shoulder.
Yeah, 90% of our listeners hear programmer, they think a person sitting in a
no,
keyboard.
No, I know, and that's what I thought of too. And you know, and it's funny reading the manual because it says, you know, think of a programmer as a television remote control. But
what an insult to programmers!
Oh, really. It's so true. It's so true. But when I walk into the doctor's office now, because I'm young in relation to these heart devices, they expect I have a much, you know, I have one of the newer devices. And my doctor actually had to make a few calls to find one of the older devices that was still, you know, sealed and sterilized and usable for me. So they don't expect me to have one, and they expect me to be able to walk into the room and to be able to, you know, to pull my results on the computer. And they look at me really confused. And I say, no, no, we need to put the programmer on top of my device. And they say, oh, it's an old one. Oh, okay, that's weird.
Do you try to explain to them the whole reasoning, or do you just...
Yes, and in fact, my technician is great, and she's actually written articles in her own right about the about problems with these medical devices, but that's a whole other issue. Mm-hmm. She basically, some of these devices are affected by like solar flare type activity, mm-hmm. and so patients of hers that have taken flights, you know, close to the poles. Mm-hmm. You know, usually have had disruptions in their devices.
Actually,
anyway.
this is totally off topic, but it'll probably be interesting to our listeners. There's actually been a number of studies about RAM. This is one of the reasons I always buy ECC RAM, which is error correcting read only memory or random access memory rather, because basically the RAMs are so dense now on modern computers because you get like 4 gigabytes RAM. That's a really really dense configuration, and the particles, the space particles going yep. through that. People have done studies that in modern RAM, you're going to get at least, I think I read an article once, I'm not going to be able to find this, I'm not going to promise, but I read an article that said that multiple times a year, you will get a read error, you'll get a bit wrong off of the RAM if you don't have ECC RAM, because it just these, eventually one of those particles going through there hits the bit you're trying to read and it flips it, and it happens every so often.
Yeah, and this is a similar problem with what happens with these heart devices, and, right. you know, patients of hers have been on the plane going to Paris or whatever, and, you know, suddenly their devices are emitting alarms and have reset, which, you know, for me is not really a problem because I'm not depending on my device for, you know,
right, people
for
who have basically no
but
ability
several
to
of
make
her
pace
patients,
themselves.
Right, require the pacemaker functionality to be able to have their heart beating, you know, such that they can function properly. So this has been a real problem for some of her patients. And so she's very interested in these issues of security, both in the unencrypted transmissions and also in the issue of free software. So, and as I've been able to find professionals for my own medical care that are, you know, are really good doctors and good nurses and good technicians, I find that they're very interested in these issues and want to know more.
So what do we do about the, because we fight this in the regular free software. There have been articles as recently as a couple weeks ago, again, about security through obscurity, and is it better if code is not disclosed because then people won't find out? And we've been having this argument in the software world for decades already, and we haven't solved it in the general software world. So I would think that people working in the medical devices area must be dug in so much further on the security through obscurity idea. So how do you guys think you're going to be able to deal with that as you start to put these FOIA requests in and start to talk to FDA regulators, maybe even start to talk to the companies? What are your plans for how to deal with explaining the security through obscurity doesn't work issue, which all of our listeners, I'm not going to go over because I'm sure like 90% of our listeners know security through obscurity doesn't work, but
what's funny
those
is
people
that,
are listening to our podcast.
All of our listeners are way more educated in this, you know, in this category than any single doctor that I've ever interacted with.
Because they believe security through obscurity must work, right? And most people believe
absolutely.
It.
Yeah, absolutely. I had dinner
they think
with
it's a locked door, right? You can't get in a locked door.
With a friend who's a pediatric cardiologist who also prescribes these devices, but for little kids. So he's also very interested in, you know, in the work that we're doing here. And he says, I don't understand. If you publish the code, aren't you inviting attackers? And it's fascinating. But, you know, talking about it in greater detail, the, you know, pointing out what the facts are, you know, and what studies have shown, and just the, you know, the common sense of it really does sway people over. So we're, part of our research is sort of focusing on bringing good examples to bear on, you know, on how security through obscurity is not really a viable option.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking for the day when you guys can introduce me to the human programmer, not the device programmer, but the human programmer who works on this, because when I have an undergraduate degree in computer science, and I don't know of a university anymore in the world that doesn't cover during some point in someone's undergraduate education the Therac 25 case, which is this extremely famous case of a radiation machine that killed people because of a software error. Yep. If you hit up and arrow to recall the last radiation amount you gave to the previous person, which is everybody's getting basically the same. So you up arrow. If you up arrowed and then arrowed right, or there was some combination of keys you could hit wrong, they would basically multiply the amount of radiation. So throughout the day, they were giving more and more radiation to people, and people died before they actually shut down the machines and stopped using
and
it.
Recently,
and this is decades ago now.
This is decades ago, but it's also you know, been in the focus recently because there was a recent, there were a few New York Times articles, profiles of people who've had incorrect radiation treatment based on software bugs.
Mm-hmm.
But I think
I remember because we were talking about that, and I said it's Therac 25 again.
Yeah.
It's
oh,
like
yeah.
Living in the past.
And there were CT scans that that were delivering ridiculous amounts of radiation to patients.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the profiles in the Times was for a breast cancer patient. There were, you know, it was a... patients from different kinds of radiation treatments and for causes, you know, that were disparate were having problems because they had or died because they had the incorrect amount of radiation delivered. So I think this is something that people are just beginning to, you know, to sort of pay attention to, even though computer scientists have used this example because it's a very easy one to understand for decades. It's something that I think the general public is just starting to think about.
Yeah. Right. You know, and something that's interesting about radiation treatment is that the medical device, well, it is medical device software that is delivering radiation. If it results in an error that, if there's an error that results in delivering too much radiation to a patient, that's relatively transparent compared to, you know, what an error might look like on an implanted heart device. You might just never know if there were an error on an implanted heart device. You know, and even if the FDA were reviewing the code that's on these devices, there have been some studies recently on the FDA pre-market approval process for medical devices generally that show that the studies are just inadequate. You know, that 65% of pre-market approvals are made on the basis of a single study, and you know, and that the studies on which approval is based are often just deeply flawed statistically.
You know what's amazing to me? I know most of my listeners know I play poker, and so I know a little bit about the gambling industry. And the machines in Las Vegas are reviewed by the Nevada Gaming Commission. More, it sounds like, than these devices are. Because they actually take the thing apart, they get all the source code, they get all the stuff, because obviously they have to make sure that if you're advertising a certain payout level, the Nevada Gaming Commission says it must pay out at that rate. And it's required by Nevada law. So they actually take the source code and they do hardware analysis and software analysis and put them together, take the machines apart, all this sort of stuff, which it sounds like the FDA is not even doing. So you're safer playing the slots. You're more sure to get what you're expecting when you play the slots than you are with
a
medical device.
Having a medical device implanted in your body that you're relying on for your safety and well-being.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, the research that we've been doing has brought some really interesting things up, like... there was one study that we read that took a look at software recalls, so at medical devices that were recalled due to software issues. And, you know, the statistics are a little weird when you read them, or the research is a little bit weird because, you know, not all of the recalls had enough information that they could easily determine what the problems were. But of the ones that had enough information, you know, of the software bug recalls, basically, recalls due to software that... that they were able to get enough information about to analyze, I think something like 98% could have been prevented by using all pairs testing.
Right, yeah.
And it was something like a
it may have been even more than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe it was more than that.
Explain what all pairs testing is.
But like testing for multiple conditions. Mm-hmm. I think the overwhelming majority of those did not require more than one or two conditions to be met in order to fail.
Wow.
So like basic software.
I mean, I can't imagine. I won't write software anymore without having full test coverage on every line. I mean, that's become a thing that people expect in the software world. I remember the Mod Pearl guys recently. It was almost a year, probably more than a year ago now. They don't maintain the old version because they don't have test coverage, and they have full test coverage for the newer version. Like, we just can't maintain. We can't trust that this code actually works, and we're not going to maintain that version of Mod Pearl. And that's just to run Pearl scripts on your website. And they're saying, we need full test coverage. And I would expect to see a full test suite of any of this stuff. There should be an emulator and a full test suite that runs a full, you know, and checks to make sure all the lines of code are covered. Some of the stuff's probably hand-coded in assembler. At best, it's written in C. I really doubt that it's written in anything of a higher level language, because there's just not enough stuff. So at best, it's written in C. It's more likely written in a mix of C and assembler, I would think. These devices. They're probably mostly C now, maybe with some inline assembly when absolutely necessary. But the people know what, anybody who's written C knows what a segmentation fault is, and the idea that you can have a seg fault on your heart device, I mean, it's insane.
Yeah, were talking about...
I mean, there's no room to fit a garbage collector, right? You can't use garbage collector C. Sorry, I'm geeking out a little bit. But it's like, you're not going to fit a garbage collector on one of these devices, so it's going to have to be standard C with no memory management, with human memory management, and humans screw up. They malloc something and don't free it. They free something that wasn't mallocked, and...
Yeah, you know, it's funny, we were sitting...
Your heart crashes. I'm sorry, I'm going to scare Karen now.
You know, it's funny, because I was just thinking about this, that we were talking about this here one day over a lunch table, and Eben Moglen, our founder, leaned over and he said, there are bugs on these devices. It's software. It has bugs. Your hard device, you know, like, he wasn't even saying your hard device, but, you know, he just said, of course, there are bugs in all of these devices. And all of a sudden my stomach flipped, and he's right. You know, I mean, there are going to be bugs on these devices. And the only way to help minimize the impact of it is to make sure that the code is auditable and it's getting a proper review, because right now it seems to us like it's not.
Yeah, I mean, I'd want to at least run Valgrind against it to see if their memory leaks. I mean, at the very least.
Looking at the numbers, it's really astounding what it seems like basic testing is not being done.
So what's next for you guys? What's the next thing you guys are going to try to do?
Well, the next thing we want to do is, it's not really the next thing. It's we're pursuing a number of things right now in our research. And again, we have the FOIA request pending and all that. But you know, the next thing we want to do here is to ask our listeners for help. You know, we're in the middle of this work, and we're, you know, you'll hopefully hear more from us as time passes.
So what specifically could our listeners do?
Well, I just, you know, I, what I'm saying is if you know of someone who's a medical security expert, or if you have any particular expertise in this area, you know, let us know, and because we could really use help.
So if we have doctors who are listeners, would that be helpful?
That would also be very helpful. Yeah, doctors. You know, actually, if you're someone who cares about free software,
medical doctors, we don't need any. We know enough PhDs in computer science, so yeah.
If you have an implanted medical device, it might be interesting to hear from you. If you choose to talk to other people about that.
I want to say, Karen, it's very nice of you to be willing to talk about this and to be a person that wants to discuss this about yourself.
Well, which you
is
know,
very, it
honestly,
is a private thing, and it's very nice of you to bring
this
issue up.
It took me a while to feel comfortable doing it, but I was so terrified, you know, when I first realized that I needed the device, and then when I realized that the issues I was concerned about were issues that the doctors had never heard of and didn't understand, it made me even more uncomfortable. So it's something that we at least need to talk about. You know, basic things like doctors saying, you know, why do you think that someone would act maliciously? You know, being able to say now that we've done research, and Laura's found some great examples of, you know, of malicious activity. Do you want to, I mean, I think you were just pointing out the...
Sure, yeah, I was just... some things that I had read about in some articles that were discussing these particular problems referenced these attacks that happened on websites frequented by epilepsy patients. Attackers actually placed images that would induce seizures in photosensitive epilepsy patients on websites frequented by epilepsy patients. So there are people out there who want to do harm to other people and are willing to use these methods to accomplish their objectives. I mean, or one example that a lot of people are familiar with are the 1982 Chicago Tylenol murders, when an attacker put poison into Tylenol bottles and then put those Tylenol bottles on drugstore shelves in Chicago. Seven people died from poison.
This malicious activity. So what we're doing is we're just pulling together this information.
Yeah, the interesting thing though is we do actually have other means of stopping some malicious activity, but the stuff that's not by malice is actually more scary, like the Therac-25 situation where no one intended. They were just basically it's maliciousness through apathy or laziness, mm-hmm. Because it is a certain form of maliciousness to not care enough to write a test suite for something that's going to go in somebody's body, or not allow the FDA to review it, or not allow the patient
or
to review
it. Not advocating the right resources to make sure the rush to get to market.
Correct.
But all of these things. And it's so we just want to bring all this information to one place so that, you know, we provide the tools for patients and doctors and medical device manufacturers and the FDA to have a real conversation about this. I think it's a topic that a lot of people are only starting to talk about. And you know, it becomes increasingly important as more and more people get implanted medical devices.
And as more and more implantable medical devices are built with software.
Yep.
So let's assume that, just so I can ask another question. I assume none of our listeners help, because you said the first thing that you're going to do next is try to get help from our listeners. We hope someone will write in, but in case they don't, what are you guys going to do next as far as trying to move forward?
Well, you'll hear. I don't want to make any promises. Is the thing like we're researching
and
depending on
what
we find, you know, depending on what we find, you know, and what conclusions we draw, it might be different. But as I said, the thing that we're most concerned about is pulling this information together so that doctors and patients have
real... The FOIA request you already filed, what is the... How long do they have to respond?
So they have 20 days to respond, and they've responded to us to tell us that our request was complex.
Cute. Oh, okay.
And that because it was complex, it's queued in a, you know, along with other complex requests. And that was 6 months ago. Mm-hmm. And we're waiting. Sometimes FOIA requests take years.
Is there any other mechanism you could use to apply pressure to get it filled more quickly or to get in communication with somebody about it?
We're exploring our options to see what the situation is. You know, we're trying to work with publicly available information as best we can to put together compelling arguments so that people have the tools to advocate for change.
Okay. Well, I think you've answered all my questions. Maybe we'll get some questions in. I'm sure we could do a follow-up show at some point if people have questions.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, we've been working on this for a little while, but in a way, we're just starting. So, you know, we would appreciate feedback, and you'll probably hear more from us as we go.
Yeah, we'll look to batching all that, and probably in some future show. Probably it won't be the next show, but at some point in the future, we'll do a show that covers it again and gets an update from both of you. And thank you for joining us, Laura.
Great. Thanks again.
Yeah, so it's my great office studio.
And we normally say questions to podcast at.
Podcast@softwarefreedom.org.
And donations on the softwarefreedom.org website.
I started saying Ogcast instead of podcast.
I saw that in your dents.
Yeah, I just decided to start saying it. Nothing official now, but I think it's better. So I will set up Ogcast@softwarefreedom.org.
I think you should.
But I'll leave the old one working. It's not going to disable the old address. But ogcast@softwarefreedom.org. And on Freenode, you can find us at /SFLC, which is an IRC channel on Freenode. I had to warn the people there that I was recording this now, so they're all actually waiting for me to leak show stuff, but we're not going to put it out until next week anyway. So
right.
We're recording this on the Monday before, so it's a full 8 days before you're hearing this. And I think that's it. And you can get in touch with us and give us feedback.
See you next time.
The Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license.
A fitting episode to have Valentine's Day week.
I don't know, our listeners might consider it quite shocking.